Revelation 4:1 is where we are this morning. Am I on? Is the camera turned on for recording Sunday school? Thanks, John. Okay, so 4:1, after these things. Okay, what are the these things? So the these things are the first, those seven churches of Asia Minor. I preached through that whole series a few weeks ago, right? If you don't have the sheet, please put your hand up. George is there and he'd be happy to give it to you. I don't want anybody to be without. Okay, so these things are those seven churches. So John is on, it's Sunday. He's been banished to Patmos, which is an island off the coast of Ephesus in the Aegean Sea. So he's off Turkey's, modern day Turkey's coast. We don't know that he was working the salt mines. John is probably 80, depending on how old he was when Christ was alive. He's probably 80, 85. History tells us he was thrown in a pot of boiling oil to kill him and he didn't die. And they fished him out. So if that's true, he's badly scarred with second and third degree burns. And he's living in a slave's quarters, which is nothing more than a cave on that island. Generally, the Romans sent salt was a commodity that they used to pay troops. So to have a large standing army, the Romans had a 160,000 man army. They used salt, they used silver, and they used gold as payment. You say, they used salt as payment. Yes, it was before refrigerators. It was before freezers. So if you owned a salt mine, you were wealthy because it was a preservative. You could salt your meat and go on a long journey with your meat like a Roman army would, and the meat didn't get rotten. It didn't spoil. It was like having an eternal MRE. I remember in Desert Storm eating K rations from World War II. Okay, so for those of you who don't realize, World War II ended in 1945. And I was in Desert Storm in 1992, the end of 92, or the end of Desert Storm was in early 92. So you do the math on how old that stupid can of brownie was. So you peeled off, it had a little thing on top of it, and you take the can, and you would go around, and you pulled out the brownie, and the brownie was minimum of 1945, 50, 92, that's 42. So the brownie is a minimum of 47 years old. And it tasted as bad when I ate it probably as the day it came out of whatever factory made this thing. So they didn't need that. They needed salt. Salt was a payment method. So to keep their standing army happy, Rome had to constantly be at war because they paid their army basically minimum wage from their gold, silver, and salt mines. And they put the slaves in those mines to create the gold, silver, and salt to pay the army. And the way the soldiers got rich was plunder. So that's why Rome for 700 years was constantly at war, because the only way Rome got rich was plunder. They didn't create new technologies, whether it's the car or AI. They didn't create new technologies, they plundered. And quite frankly, that's been the history of the world. It's only been in the last couple of hundred years with capitalism that we've created things, and we've created computers, and we've created the car, and we've because the way empires were built was always built on plunder. They paid their standing army a minimum wage, and then the standing army got all the plunder. So the standing army was incentivized to kill people and take plunder. That's how they got rich. Okay, that's why Jesus says, when the soldiers come to him, and Jesus says, "What should we do?" And he says, "Take no more than what you're owed." That's not what Roman soldiers did. That's how they got rich, was plundering people. Okay, so that's where John finds himself. Probably an 85, 90-year-old man in that range. And he's now written a letter to the senior pastors of all seven churches, commending them and reproving them. He was from that area, had ministered there for a long time. He gets banished to the Isle of Patmos. And this is, the book is the revelation of Jesus Christ. So the revelation means it's the revealing of Jesus Christ and his plan. Now, as I've talked to you before, there are some believers that believe all of Revelation has already been fulfilled. They believe that this book is describing the lead up to the destruction of Jerusalem, and they believe we are living in the millennium right now. Does anybody remember the name for that belief system? It's okay if you don't. What's that? No, post-millennial. Because we're amillennial will say there's no millennium. Post-millennialism says we're living in the millennium right now, and we're in the spiritual aspect of the millennium. In the future, somewhere in the distant future, they agree with us, there'll be a literal millennium. But right now, Satan is bound. We're going to see about Satan bound for 1,000 years. 1,000 years in their mind is not mean 1,000 years. It's just a big number. And Satan was bound on the day Christ died. He conquered sin. He conquered Satan. And so we're living in the millennium right now. My comment is, wow, if Satan is bound, a lot of bad stuff happens with a bound Satan over the last 2,000 years. Think Hitler. Think Genghis Khan. Think World War I. Think ISIS. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on and on and on, doesn't it, for Satan to be bound. So I completely reject, even though I have some good friends that hold to that view, I just say, that is just so... And what you also have to do is they want to place all the book of Revelation in 60s. In other words, it's John at 90 writing a book basically about what happened in 65. So all of the figures in the book of Revelation are about the Roman army coming to take down Jerusalem. That's what the great dragon is. And they reinterpret all. So it's not futurist. It's looking back. Well, I'm not really sure why John would write this book to people to describe what's already happened and do it in such symbolic language. That's number one. And number two, to believe that Satan is bound just absolutely defies understanding as far as I'm concerned. I would hate to see what the Old Testament was like when he wasn't bound. Okay, so John is going to see Jesus Christ, and this is a vision of what's to come. Remember, prophecy is always given to a minority, depressed, attacked, seemingly inconsequential, for the purpose of asserting that God is in control. Remember, Ezekiel is given to Ezekiel. He's 20 years into the 70-year captivity, and he predicts a beautiful temple for five chapters, 40, 41, 42, 43, 44, of a glory. And the Jews were down to a handful of thousand of people, some in Egypt and the rest in Babylon. And God says, I got this. There's going to come a great Messiah. I'm not done with you. The covenant isn't over. My promises are sure. I will always keep my word. And he gives it to these handful of Jews. Then Daniel comes along later and says, wait a second, here's the laying out of history, 70 weeks, 490 years, and by the way, from Revelation 4 to Revelation 19, this is Daniel's 70th week. This is the fulfillment of Daniel 9:27. What we're seeing here in Revelation 4, 5, 6, 7, all the way to chapter 19. So Daniel's in Babylonian captivity. When he writes now, he's going to be in Persian captivity. So God writes, I got this. I still have a future for the Jewish people. And he outlines very clearly what's going to happen with Antiochus Epiphanes, Alexander the Great. That's why liberals look at Daniel's prophecies and go, oh, Daniel had to be. There's not a real Daniel. This has to be written in the first century BC because he so clearly explains Alexander the Great. He so clearly explains the Medo-Persian Empire. He so clearly explains the coming Roman Empire. This can't happen to the real Daniel living in the 6th century BC. It must be somebody that takes his name and writes in the 1st century BC after Rome was a great power. Because you get to Daniel and his explanation of the Greek battles over Israel are so clear. You remember when I went through all that verse by verse? It's like blows your mind how accurate it is for someone to be predicting that 300 years in the future. So what we are now getting to after all this time is Daniel's 70th week, the Great Tribulation. This happens after the rapture. Remember, the rapture happens, and then the Antichrist, according to Daniel 9:27, is going to form a covenant with Israel for 1 week, for 7 years. 1 week, 7 years, and in the middle of that week, Daniel 9:27 says he breaks it. So the tribulation, Revelation 4, begins with the Antichrist. We're not going to see it here. We see that in Daniel, but you layer them on top of one another, and this is the beginning of the tribulation. The rapture does not start the tribulation. The covenant between the Antichrist and Israel does. Won't that be a miraculous day in world history? Look at what's going on in Israel today. Hezbollah? Are you watching the news? Hamas? Israel is facing its greatest existential threat ever. Ever. Because as Hezbollah has said, we are glad all the Jews got in one place because that's why we can kill them all at one time. Don't you think with the way media is and AI is and the brainwashing that we've seen in the last 5 years, don't you think when the Antichrist is able to broker a peace treaty between all the Arab nations and Israel, he will be hailed as the greatest human to ever live? Right? Every Google search will be anti... This man, of course, he won't be called Antichrist. He won't be called the Beast. He'll have a name, human name. And every AI search of him will be greatest ever. Wonderful. Every Google search will be he is the prophesied Messiah. Who else could get the Jews and the Arabs to be at peace with one another? Who else could get the Russians and the Americans to be at peace with one another? He is such a man of peace. And oh, by the way, most likely by that time you'll have a digital currency anyway. So if you don't go along with that, when you go to scan your hand at the grocery store, you won't eat. Because that's what we're going to read in Revelation. We're going to read in Revelation that there's a 200 million man army coming out of the east. When John wrote this, there were 1 billion people or less on planet Earth. So all through the Middle Ages, there were only about 1 billion people. And even in the 1700s, 1800s, liberals mocked that. Postmillennialists said, oh, it's just a made-up number. Amillennialists said it's a made-up number. And like I told you last week, today in all the uniformed services of China alone, there are 90 million. Now I'm talking police. I'm talking reserves. I'm talking their version of the guard. I'm talking their version of active duty. There's 90 million in China alone today. 90 million. 90 million. Do you know China today spends more money on its internal security than it does its Air Force, Army, Navy, and space program? Because they're terrified that their people hate them. Okay? So, this is the trailer to the movie. Okay? So, Revelation 4, after these things I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven. Verse 1, and the first voice which I heard was like a trumpet speaking with me, saying, come up here, and I will show you things which must take place. What's the next two verses? After this, not before this. After this. This is future. Immediately I was in the Spirit. And behold, a throne set in heaven, and one sat on the throne, and he who sat there was like a jasper and a sardius stone in appearance, and there was a rainbow around the throne in appearance like an emerald. Around the throne were 24 thrones, and on the thrones I saw 24 elders sitting, clothed in white robes, and they had crowns of gold in their head, and from the throne proceeded lightnings, thunders, and voices. Seven lamps of fire were burning before the throne, which are the seven spirits of God. So if you're looking at my notes, I say, remember the context is John, banished to the island of Patmos off the Turkish coast. He is seeing a vision of Christ on Sunday. It's the Lord's Day. Why do we call today the Lord's Day? Because John says it. That's where we get it in the book of Revelation. He was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day. We know that they had changed their time of worship from Saturday to Sunday to celebrate the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Every Sunday we worship together celebrates the resurrection of Jesus Christ, because he arose on Sunday. They wanted to distinguish themselves from the Jewish ethnicity, even though many of them were ethnic. And let me just tell you this. There is a verse in Galatians that says, the Israel of God. And my amillennial friends and my postmillennial friends will say the church is the Israel of God. That is absolutely not true. The Israel of God are Jewish, true believers in the Messiah who are Jewish. They use that Israel of God to mean the church, to say the church has replaced Israel and there's no future for the Jewish people in God's economy, that we've replaced them. I'm just here to tell you, we haven't replaced Israel. God has a plan for the Jewish people. His promises are given and they are not revocable. God does not lie. God does not lie. So he says he has written, I'm back in my notes, seven letters to seven churches not far from where he is. We studied those letters just recently in Sunday morning services. He addresses them to the senior pastor of each church. Some have compliments, but most are a mixed bag of compliments and rebukes. Some will teach you that the rest of the book is past and fulfilled in AD 70 and the destruction of Jerusalem. However, this book wasn't written until about 90. And by the way, that dating of the book is held by every ancient church historian. Eusebius writes about this a couple hundred years later, and he dates John to 90-ish AD. Multiple early church pastors date John to 90 AD. What's one of the better established timings of books than any of the New Testament books is roughly 90 AD, because so many people later on refer to this book, and we have their writings, okay? So you have to say, if you're a postmillennialist, you have to believe that John is writing backwards about events that took place 20 or 25 years before, which makes zero sense. Now, they make a great case for it, but at the bottom line, it makes zero sense because chapter 4 and verse 1 says, which must take place after this. Okay? If that view is correct, I'm back in my notes, it's known as postmillennialism, then John just is recording quite a great deal of vivid imagery for a historic event. That really makes very little sense, quite frankly. As a premillennial, pre-tribulational, okay, premillennial means Christ comes before the millennium and a literal millennium. Pre-tribulational means Christ comes before the tribulation and gathers his church. We understand uses of metaphors and imagery. In other words, there's going to be imagery and metaphors all through the book of Revelation. That doesn't mean that there's not an actual Antichrist, even though he's referred to as the beast. It doesn't mean he's Bigfoot. We're not going to find Bigfoot in the forest ruling over the world. But that's an imagery. But behind the imagery is a real truth, okay? What my postmillennial, amillennial friends will say is, oh, the imagery. Yes, I see your hand, John. Yes. Yes. So part of the argument is that in the replacement theology is when Paul refers to us being grafted into the vine in Romans, what, 9, 10, 11, 12, that area, that means we replace. We say, no, Paul is writing to the church age. We don't replace, we're grafted together as this new organism called a multi-ethnic organism, the church. Just because we're grafted in for this dispensation doesn't mean that God still won't keep his promises to Israel, and there's not still a 70th week of Daniel and a literal tribulation and a literal millennium. What they say is because we've been grafted in, that means the church has been replaced. And Ray and Greg and I think we talked about this when we were out visiting, passing out flyers on Friday, or I talked someplace about it. But the point of grafting in isn't that we replace Israel. It means for this dispensation, we have a multi-ethnic church organism of which Christ is the head. But that doesn't mean there's not a future for Israel. God's promises to the church are to the church, and God's promises to Israel are to Israel. It's hard to explain why the Jews exist today if God doesn't still have a plan for them. It just is. Where are the Philistines? You know where the Philistines are? No, I'm joking. I'm joking, Lorna. Your head went up. Lorna, go ahead. You have a question. Mm-hmm. So just like the Jews were arrogant because they had been picked, we should never be arrogant because we've been picked. We should be humble. Like I always say, there's two kinds of people in the world, the humble and those about to be humble. Get your pick. There's two kinds of people in the world, the humble and those about to be humble. Absolutely. So, as a premillennial, pre-tribulational believer, we understand use of metaphors and imagery but we also believe in a normal and grammatical historical interpretation of Scripture. That means God uses imagery, metaphors, but behind the imagery, metaphors is a real meaning of real future events. You can't just say, like they do, oh, see, it's the real meaning of Revelation is God wins. Those, there's the metaphors and the imagery. It means that God, there's nothing else really there. Nope, that's not it. I don't delve in my notes over the next few weeks. I won't delve into a lot of speculation as that is not the point. Thank you, Steve. Steve's bringing me water because I'm clearing my throat. I appreciate that. Thank you. When it gets really dry, like it gets here, I just drink and drink and drink to keep moisture on my vocal folds. And I struggle from all the burn pits in Desert Storm. So that's, they're going to pay me for that with my VA disability. So all my wife's annoyances all this year will be compensated. Well, they probably won't be compensated for, but I don't know. There's enough money for her patients to pay for all of her patients with me. But so I don't delve into a lot of speculation, as that is not the point. The point of prophecy, and I've said this already, is always about encouraging downtrodden people that God is in control and His will always overcomes Satan's legions. If you don't get anything out of 2 years of study of prophecy, get that sentence. The point of prophecy is always about encouraging downtrodden people that God is in control and His will always overcomes Satan's legions. Wow, that's powerful. So verse 1, we've already read it. If you notice that the first phrase gives a time reference, after these things. So the after, forward, he's written currently in 90 AD to the seven churches. And now after that, he's looking forward, right? That's not going back. That's looking forward. And I say, after these things leads one not to believe these next chapters are recounting a historical event, but rather they look to the future. The events must occur in the future, and God is going to show John these future events as he writes to a church that's about to go through 230 years of constant death, persecution, being eaten by lions, drowned, put on crosses and burnt. I mean, they are about to go and have already gone through. Paul is dead at the hand of Nero. Peter is dead at the hand of Nero. Nero has lit his gardens with Christians on fire 25 years before this. So they've already gone through some persecution, and it's going to get way worse in the future. And he's going to write to them saying, God is still in control. What purpose would being writing about past events due to persecuted, murdered, ethnically cleansed, all the things that we talk about, the memes that are out there, that happened to the Christians until 313 AD. Okay? So, verse 2 and 3, he is taken up in the spirit, but seeing heaven. So I'm going to describe verses 2 and 3. He says in verse 2, immediately I was in the spirit, and there's a throne set, and one, this is God himself, sat on the throne. And he who sat there was like a jasper and a sardius stone in appearance. And there was a rainbow around the throne, an appearance like an emerald. Around the throne were 24 thrones, and on the thrones I saw 24 elders sitting, clothed in white robes, and they had crowns of gold on their head. Okay, what does this mean? Verse 2, the jasper is clear, not like more opaque jasper stones known today. And you can see that reference is one of the foundation stones of the New Jerusalem in chapter 21 and verse 18. The sardius, so it's a very clear stone, a very, very beautiful, clear stone. The sardius was a ruby-colored stone. So think reddish, purplish, a ruby-colored stone. These two stones were the first and last worn on the high priest's breast. So the high priest had a breast, and it had 12 stones on it for the 12 tribes of Israel when he went into the Holy of Holies. So these two stones are the first and the last. Are you tracking with what I'm saying? Yeah. Alpha and Omega. And that Christ fulfills prophet, priest, and king. He's prophet, priest, and king. So God highlights for John that these stones are the first and the last on the high priest's vestment. That's not an accident. That's not an accident how God does that. Okay? So they will be used as the foundation in the New Jerusalem. You can see that, Revelation 21, 19 to 20. The throne had a rainbow over its top resembling an emerald. And I'm going to be really kind here, but this was not an LGBTQ rainbow. It wasn't. It wasn't. It resembles an emerald. It has a green hue to it. The rainbow is to remind the readers that God, listen to me, this is because this is now Daniel's 70th week. Israel has been set aside for 2,000 years. They've gone through the Holocaust. They've gone through the pogroms of Spain, of France, of Russia. The Israel has gone, and God gives them a rainbow. John sees a rainbow before he introduces the tribulation, which is God once again working with the Jewish people with 144,000 Jewish witnesses. Why? Because the rainbow was the symbol of God's covenant with Noah. And he's saying, I'm a covenant-keeping God with Israel. I've not forgotten you. I have not left you alone. I have always been there. And we see that there is a rainbow, which is the covenant-keeping symbol of God to Noah. That what? What's the covenant he makes with Noah after the flood? What does the rainbow symbolize? Has God destroyed the world with a flood since then? No. And if God keeps that promise to Noah, he's now reminding this the church with the rainbow, I still have a future for Israel. And I'm going to tell you about the future for Israel because we're going to see 144,000 Jews that are selected and saved to be the evangelists during the tribulation. And if you believe this is all past, you have to take this whole chapter we're going to get to on the 144,000 Jews and just say it doesn't mean anything. God's just blathering. Let me tell you something. God doesn't just blather. Mike Sproul may blather. God doesn't. Okay? God doesn't just write stuff down for no reason. So verse 4, around the throne, and I'll close with verses 4 and 5. I'm almost done. Around the primary throne, there were lesser thrones. It seems these 24 elders, okay. So literally, you ask a guy who writes commentary on Revelation, and you'll get a different opinion. There's about 5 different opinions about these 24 elders. Here is what I think, and I'll tell you what my understanding is. Because if you look at verse 4, he saw 24 elders sitting, clothed in white robes. They had crowns of gold on their heads, and from the throne proceeded lightnings, thunders, and voices. 7 lamps of fire were burning before the throne, which are the 7 spirits of God. That's verse 5. So, around the primary throne, which is God's, it seems these 24 elders were lesser thrones, 24 elders. It seems they represent the church that has been raptured. They're in white robes. If it's the church that's been raptured, we see Christ. We are no longer under the power, the presence of sin, Satan. We are clothed in white robes to never sin again. Won't that be a glorious event? Freed from the power and the temptation of sin. They had victor crowns on their heads that were awarded when someone won an Olympic event. They had won the race of life. They were faithful to the end. Wow. I don't know about you, but more than anything else, I want God to give me a victor crown. That I was faithful in my generation. We will see these elders in chapter 5 as well. The word presbyteros, or elder, is only used of humans. So some have said they're angels around the throne. Except it's used of pastors. It's the word, one of the words to designate the pastor's role as an overseer of the workforce, because that's what the word elder, presbyteros, means. It's only used of humans, and it is used multiple times for pastors. The number 24 is often used as completion, as there were 24 officers of the sanctuary representing the 24 courses of Levitical priests in 1 Chronicles 24. So the Levitical priesthood, if you remember when Elizabeth was with child and her husband was serving in the temple, because he was of the tribe of Levi, so how they did that is you had 48 weeks each, you had a course, and you went and served in the temple for 1 week and went back and farmed. Then later in the year, you came and served another week. Well, that gets you to 48 weeks. They had 4 weeks left over. Then you had 3 travel feasts, Pentecost, Passover and the week of booths, the festival of booths. So everybody came to those weeks. So the priests served 5 weeks a year, and you had 1 week of vacation. So the 5 weeks gets you to 51. So 48 is two courses, then 3 weeks of travel, and you give yourself a little bit of time for travel back and forth, and you basically have one, it's 51 weeks, you have a week not to be involved and be at your farm. Does that make kind of sense? So the 24 is a number of completion. Then here's my answer to this. Therefore, the last couple of sentences, since only the church is complete, not yet Israel, right? Israel's not complete. Therefore, since only the church is complete, not yet Israel, as they will be saved from the witnesses of the 144,000 that is still future to this chapter, it seems these elders represent the church and church age saints. It seems that they represent the raptured, glorified church that could truly sing the song of the redeemed in Revelation 5 when we get there. Okay. I know I'm late. Comment or question? I wanted to fly through that because I had somebody say, please talk about the elders. I'm going to be gone. I'm like, okay. So I'll get to the elders. I'll get to the elders. Was that you, Ken? Did you ask me about that? See, I didn't know if I got all your question answered, but I held us in a couple extra minutes late to give you the answer. You can read a different commentary, Ken, and you'll get a different answer. That's my answer. Okay. Yes, June, go ahead. Oh, yes. So it is in your notes. It's the bottom sentence of that first big long paragraph under Revelation 4. But I'm happy to say it again. People are watching online. So the point of prophecy is always about encouraging downtrodden people that God is in control and his will always overcomes Satan's legions. I mean, you think about it. One man cast Christ cast out a demon and they said, what is your name? And he said, Legion, for we are many. A legion had over 6,000 troops. That man, if we take it literally, that means there were 6,000 demons. No wonder they could go into hundreds and hundreds of pigs and they run down the... I mean, the man was invaded by thousands of demons. So when I say Satan's legions, sometimes we don't understand that there are millions of demons. And if you don't think they don't live in Washington, D.C., and Beijing, and Moscow, and London, and Paris... and thriving. Yeah, the Prince of Persia. Remember in Daniel, the Prince of Persia that opposes Israel?